I have to apologize to our next speaker because we have only one screen here. Tim is well known in the community for giving multimedia presentations that involve multiple screens. I think your record was 4 at a Gordon conference once. I have to say some more bad things about you.
Let's get on.
Okay, icosahedral image processing.
Let's see if I get this on here.
Sorry about that.
No. He used at least 6. He had at least 6.
And his talk was, I think, an hour and 3 minutes.
You've already taken away 30 seconds of my time, so I have to start by saying that Ron lied to you. I mean, I can't believe Ron would do this, but first thing he said this morning was, "This is going to be a short day." Okay, we'll see how short it really is. Okay, don't get your hopes up, because this is the last movie you're going to see from me, actually. If I could even get this to work again. Okay, so Wad did a wonderful job of showing you how to investigate your structures, and this is not a talk about results. It's a talk about basically how do we get from here to there. And so I'm not going to tell you, I'll tell you right up front, I'm not going to talk about results. I'm going to talk about methods, okay? That's what you students are here to learn about. So quickly, an outline, give you an idea of where you're going to be for the next 4 hours. I'll start out with a little bit of background, sort of set the stage, and then talk a little bit about symmetry. I could talk several lectures just about that topic alone, but I won't. I'm not going to go through the... Can you hear me when I turn my head this way?
Yes.
Okay. Basically go through the nuts and bolts of what I would consider a typical procedure, but realize there's other groups in the world that do it slightly differently, but the basics, I think, are still the same. And if I have any time left over before you all take off for lunch, I'll say a little bit about current and future strategies. But before I get started on my main talk here, I want to say just a couple things. I'm sure this is going through all the students' minds and maybe even some of the instructors, and that is, how did the organizers of this conference choose the people to get up here and talk about these methods? Okay, so we have 4 people here. I couldn't find a picture for this person, but this will do. And as you know, you heard about two-dimensional crystals. It may be that he just finished eating one of these lasagnas that he didn't actually cook well enough. And then there are people that are twisted, okay, and or mad, and you can wonder why this guy is smiling, but I think it's because he's the only one here who's actually retired. And then you wonder why this person is so worried about trying to study structures that have this beautiful symmetry. What's more beautiful than a sphere, right? And then there's this guy over here who hasn't shown up yet, I don't think. He hasn't gotten here yet, so I can take as many cracks as I want. He looks like he's clenching his teeth. I think that's because he doesn't want to really let you know that he plays with these little rubber duckies. And mark my word, when he gets up here, he's going to try and convince you that they're looking at these objects in ice and that this is going to give you some real structure. But realize also that he's probably also not going to tell you that he spent many, many years looking at these structures in negative stain. So he's going to try and woo you by saying that he can understand the differences in density of these structures and see differences in RNA and protein and whatnot. And he's even going to probably tell you that he can segment the structure up and tell you where every little bit and piece is. Now, you also realize that most of us in this field work in real space and reciprocal space. Some of us more in reciprocal than real space. And you remember that in reciprocal space, this problem, even Vincent told you, it's quite easy. Basically, it's just a bunch of spots, and it's easy to see those spots, okay, and measure them and measure their intensities and where they are. So the Fourier transform is actually quite informative about the structure. It tells you quite a bit about it. I'm not sure why he's not smiling, because it's certainly very easy to see those spots. And then there's this guy again, I'm not sure why he's smiling, but he just told you last hour that, in fact, he also has spots, but they're a little bit blurry in the equatorial direction. But he still has spots, so he can see things and understand his structure in a fairly good way by identifying these spots, even though they're a bit smeary. And then you wonder what's going on over here. Well, again, it's kind of hard to understand why this guy is having so much trouble trying to figure out what the structure of this thing is. And it's probably because the Fourier transform doesn't tell you very much either. It's circularly symmetric and hasn't got a lot of information in it, or at least it doesn't appear to have a lot of information. And then we get back to this example again. Of course, the Fourier transform is kind of a mess, okay? It's much, much more difficult with single particles to look at the transform and understand, you know, what object gave rise to that. And of course, too, we don't really have an ideal situation here. We are looking at small objects in very noisy images, and of course, the transform also is noisy. So even though with crystals and helices, the Fourier transform is a very powerful way to analyze your images, the same is true of single particles, but it's not something you really can do even by eye. We have to analyze them in other ways, and I'll try and explain that to you as I go along. Okay, so getting down to the real science, the science I'm going to talk to you about today actually started in 1970 with this landmark paper. And you'll notice there's a who's who of investigators, well, all but one, on this list. Tony Crowther, Linda Amos, John Finch, and Aaron Klug, and whoever this guy is here. This is a landmark paper in the field for what those of us who do icosahedral reconstruction do. And I invite anybody to read these articles. They're just wonderful. And in this article, they presented the first two reconstructions, three-dimensional reconstructions. Of course, back in those days, things were studied in stain. And they were of human wart virus, a papillomavirus, and tomato bushy stunt virus. Okay, and these are the reconstructions that were published in that first Nature paper. And then for those of you who want to dig a little bit deeper, like David said, when you have a couple weeks' time and you want to learn about Fourier-Bessel transforms, etc., these are the Bible for that, for understanding the mathematics that goes on in reconstructing three-dimensional structures from these images. And the basic principles are formulated in this Fourier-Bessel mathematics. I was hoping David was going to do all that for me so I wouldn't have to do it. So both of us are going to wave our hands a little bit. And then this idea of common lines, and I'm going to attempt, maybe it's the last time I'll ever do this, but I'm going to attempt to show you what these common lines are, just to give you a basic idea of just how clever these people were in terms of determining how to get something out of these transforms that are very difficult to understand by eye, transforms of a single particle, for example. And for those of you diehards, there's a more recent review that we wrote, and there's some others as well that I can identify, at least to the people who are in the icosahedral practical. Anybody else that's interested, I can sort of dig up some of these. I've got a few left of this review that Norm Olson, Steve Fuller, and I wrote several years ago that, again, sort of lays out how to do this for cryo-EM specimens. Okay, so for many years, we've looked at spherical viruses, icosahedral viruses, and they span the size range from about less than 300 angstroms here for this parvovirus B19 to over 1,200 angstroms for herpes simplex virus. And these are all fairly low-resolution structures solved using these techniques. One of the largest ones we've looked at is this Paramecium brucella chlorella virus. It's a virus that infects algae that are in symbiotic relationship with the paramecium. And in fact, Xiaodong Yan, who's in the audience back here from my lab, is the one that solved this structure. It's almost 2,000 angstroms in diameter. So again, you've heard this over and over again, that cryomicroscopy is well suited to study especially these very large structures that likely can't be crystallized, or at least it's going to take a while to get good crystals for X-ray diffraction studies, for example, to these kinds of resolutions. This is at about 16 angstroms. Is that right? Of course, once you get these things in the computer, you can color them. It helps you to interpret. But again, Wah did a wonderful job of showing you how we can use these, and I think we'll actually hear some more about visualization later on in the course, so I'm not going to say much about that. So enough for the background. I want to say a little bit about symmetry. So there's two aspects I want to talk about, and believe me, it's not going to be too long. It's not going to be a full 2 hours. It'll only be about an hour. First thing is, what is this thing called icosahedral or 532 point group symmetry? And the second thing is triangulation symmetry. What does this tell us? So let's start with icosahedral point group symmetry. So let's roll back the clock about a couple thousand years, and I'm going to tell you the whole history here. Okay, so many of you maybe in grammar school heard about these things called Platonic solids. There's only five of them. There's not four, there's not six, there's only five. And if you take equilateral triangles and try and make a solid out of equilateral triangles, you have a couple choices. You can take, by taking four of these, putting three faces at each vertex, you produce a tetrahedron. That's the first Platonic solid. If you take four of them and put them at each vertex, you generate what's called an octahedron. If you take and put five of these faces at each vertex, you create what's called an icosahedron. And if you then take squares, so these are the equilateral triangles, if you take squares, you can make a cube, okay, three faces at each vertex. And if you have pentagons, you can put with three faces at each vertex, you produce what's called a dodecahedron. That's it. That's all there is in terms of the Platonic solids. So one of those Platonic solids is this icosahedron. Here's a view of it looking down a threefold axis. But this particular Platonic solid, the icosahedron, has 12 vertices. It's 12 fivefold axes, and here they are. You can only see some of them because I'm just showing you the front half here. But coming out of each vertex and projecting right through the center of the particle are these 12 fivefold vertices. There's actually six axes, okay, because if you look from either side, there's going to be one on each side. So there's six unique fivefold axes. There's 20 faces on this icosahedron, and they correspond to threefold views. And here they are, at least some of them. So the axis that passes right through the middle of each triangle and goes through the center of the particle is a threefold axis of symmetry. And lastly, there's 30 edges here, and if you pass an axis of symmetry through an edge through the center, you create a twofold axis of symmetry. And here's some of those. Okay? And it's the combination of all of those symmetries together that make up the icosahedron. It turns out that icosahedrons and dodecahedrons, which is another Platonic solid, in fact have the same symmetry, although different shapes. So the icosahedron, I told you already, has 12 vertices, 20 faces, 30 edges, which correspond to 6 fivefolds, 10 threefolds, and 15 twofolds. The dodecahedron has 20 vertices, 12 faces, and 30 edges, but it also has 6 fivefolds, 10 threefolds, and 15 twofolds. What's important is that the asymmetric unit of each one of these is 1/60th of the whole object. And that's shown here for the icosahedron. And there's a couple ways that you could choose this. Cryo-EM, or the EM community, has chosen an asymmetric unit to go from two adjacent fivefolds to the nearest threefold. So that region there represents 1/60th of this entire structure. And the other 59 that you don't see identified here would be generated if you use those axes of symmetry to relate that asymmetric unit to the rest of the structure. So there's a 60-fold redundancy built into that structure. The dodecahedron, similarly, you can draw between these two five-fold points and a three-fold point here on the path from a five-fold to five-fold. You always pass through a two-fold. So that's an asymmetric unit if you have 60 of those total generated by the symmetry of the icosahedron. So the object consists of 60 identical subunits, and they're arranged with icosahedral symmetry. And this is this famous drawing by Don Casper, and it illustrates very nicely that icosahedral symmetry is not just a mathematical abstraction, but it relates to real structures. Of course, we've never seen the structure that looks exactly like this, but this illustrates that if you had 60, I think these are, I forget whether they're right hands or left hands. I guess they're left hands. I see the thumb here. You have 60 left hands, each hand representing, let's say, a polypeptide chain. and you arrange it with icosahedral symmetry, something interesting occurs here. You can look at the structure in different ways. You can look at it as this pair of hands here, which are related by this twofold axis here. We'll color those green. There's going to be 30 of those that make up this structure. 60 hands make up the structure. The asymmetric unit is one hand. And so if we look at the structure in terms of this just dimer interaction, there's going to be 30 of those in this icosahedron. Alternatively, we could look at these three yellow subunits that are basically connected by these fingers, and there's going to be 20 of those trimers. Same structure, just looked at in a different way. Or we could look at this ring of five hands around each of the vertices. I'm showing you one, but there's 12 of them. There's 12 pentamers. No matter how you cut it, there's 60 of these arranged according to the symmetry of the icosahedron. This just shows that in a different way, just to show the relationships. Okay, what about this thing called triangulation symmetry? Now, that really, this thing could be the subject of several lectures. So I'm just going to give you just the highlight of what I think is important, at least for the most of the people in this audience. Those who are in the practical, you can ask all the questions you want about the detail, the gory details. First thing is triangulation symmetry on its own is just a purely mathematical concept. It concerns lattices. Okay? A lattice is just a mathematical concept where infinite points are placed in space. And real objects, for example, a virus that has 5-3-2 symmetry, they often consist of multiples of 60 subunits. In fact, most viruses that are icosahedral or spherical have many more than 60. There's a few examples of very small viruses like STNV that have just 60 subunits, but most of them have multiples of 60 subunits. And that's where the idea of this triangulation symmetry comes in to help explain what's going on. And these subunits are arranged such that additional local or pseudosymmetries exist. Okay, so going back to this gallery, we can identify different structures. So HSV has the so-called triangulation symmetry T equals 16. Rotavirus, which is a reovirus, and reovirus, which is a member of the reoviridae family, are both T equals 13 structures. Ross River, which is an alpha virus, is a T equals 4. So is N omega V and N beta V. This is an insect virus. Human papillomavirus, T equals 7. So is polyoma, and so is cauliflower mosaic virus. There's a number of T equals 3s. Here's CCMV, FHV. There's a number of T equals 1 structures. Some of these are actually called P equals 3, pseudo equals 3. I'm not going to go into that here. And this is one of these strange ones. LA virus is a yeast virus. It's a so-called T equals 2, but T equals 2 is not really allowed by the mathematics, although it's called a T equals, quote-unquote, 2. What this basically tells you is that, in fact, except for the T equals 1 structures, there's many more than 60 copies that make up this entire structure. And you can already start to see that some of these have different local symmetries. So, for example, in HSV, there are hexameric units and, where is it? Yeah, pentameric units. Okay, it's a little bit harder to see in some of these other structures. But there are other symmetries that exist in addition to the icosahedral symmetry that give rise to these very beautiful but complex larger structures. Oh, and then in this one here, it turns out the T number happens to be T equals 169D. The D stands for the fact that you could have one hand or the other. In nature, there's only one hand that you see. In nature, we see only the so-called right hand or dextro hand, just like polyoma has a dextro hand. Again, I'm not going to go into the details here, just so that you understand that there is this concept. And what I want you to take home at this point is just two things. Number one, the T-symmetry is not something that gets incorporated into or enforced by the algorithms that we use to get the structures. Okay, so in fact, the T-symmetry is just one of those things that emerges as a result of doing a properly performed 3D reconstruction analysis. So in addition to the structure itself and the structure of the asymmetric unit, you get additional information about, for example, these local symmetries. It's not enforced in the procedure. Okay, so in other words, what you determine is the structure of one asymmetric unit of the object, and that can include these additional local symmetries. So these are not being enforced when we do the reconstruction process. The other thing I have to say right up front is there's two basic assumptions, and I think this is probably true in many of the different types of specimens that people talk about. The first thing is that the specimens that you're looking at and you want to put together, average together, really need to be stable particles so that when you take pictures of them, they're not in different conformations, for example. And you're making an assumption that the ones that you're going to put together are in fact identical structures. They have the same structure. If you don't, then this whole process of averaging is totally invalid. The second thing is that the programs that we use, they do test for, but they assume the presence of icosahedral symmetry. And actually, this is a very important statement, but I'm not going to say much more about it. But this is true of almost anything that you talk about in terms of specimens. So, for example, David talked about helical structures. Unless you're using EDS programs, if you come up with the wrong helical symmetry, the wrong selection rule, then whatever you do after that is going to be enforced on that structure, whether it's right or wrong. Okay, so you have to be very careful that the assumptions that you make, in our case, if we have a picture of a virus and we assume it has icosahedral symmetry, it's going to come out with icosahedral symmetry when we finish at the end of the day using these programs. So that's an important point. Okay, so let's get into the gory details of a what I call a typical procedure. And we're going to sort of step our way through fairly quickly. And go ahead and stop me if you like, if you can get my attention. Just a few words about the electron microscopy itself. We don't need a lot of sample. We do tend to need higher concentrations, though. So our molecular virology colleagues oftentimes, they don't cringe at the amount, but they cringe at the concentrations we require. We put these over Coley carbon films. We also use these quantifoil grids, but this is an older slide of homemade Coley carbon films. So the holes are on the order of about 1 micron. And you can see a blow-up view of, this is SV40 virus suspended over one of these holes. It's a nice mono-dispersed distribution of particles. There's a region over here which is bare, and I suppose in the practicals they've told you that if you see these bare zones, it's because the ice or the water before it froze got so thin, it sort of squeezes the particles out. So this is a characteristic sign that the thickness is just about right. Also, the fact that you have a monodispersed distribution, you don't have particles on top of each other, means it's not too thick. And at higher magnification, you can start to see individual particles, and of course you can see some details, but that's about it. I mean, you really have to go further, because from each particle, you really can't determine the three-dimensional structure by eye. Okay. And of course, we use these fancy microscopes, and I'm glad to see that both us and Yale use the same sort of technology. We tend to use these microscopes either at 200 or 300 kilovolts with a field emission gun. The thing I always find interesting is that the smaller the object gets, it seems the bigger and more expensive the machine you need to study that object. There just seem to be this reciprocal space relationship in terms of dollars and manpower. So we are when you're sitting at the microscope, think of yourself in reciprocal space. And in fact, right now at UCSD, we haven't got it working yet, but we have one of these FEI Techni F30 Polaris. So this will allow us to look at specimens at liquid helium temperatures if we so choose. And it has a field emission gun, and it operates at 300 kilovolts. But these are the kinds of instruments that you all realize we need to use to get to higher resolutions with our structure determinations. You all have learned now that we take our pictures out of focus. We take them at relatively low doses to reduce radiation damage. The nice thing about giving this kind of talk is I realize that people like Bob and David and Vincenz have given these wonderful talks that allow me to skip right through some of these points. We still tend to use film, but you know the day will come when we give up the ghost and go over to CCD cameras or other kinds of detectors. This microscope here will have a 4K by 4K CCD. In the not too distant past, we were trying to, for a given project, we would try to record on the order of 50 or 100 micrographs to get enough data. And I think the time is coming when we're going to probably be taking thousands, and that's going to be just almost impossible to do with film. Same is true with particles. For most of the current day structures that we've looked at, we have on the order of 1,000 minimum, up to 10,000 and more, several 10,000s particles that we use. We're trying to gear up to look at maybe 10 to the fifth particles, and somewhere down the road we'll probably be looking at millions of particles. And this puts certain constraints on the kind of processing that we do. The target resolution right now that we're able to achieve is somewhere, we hope to get to at least 10 angstroms with most of our structures, and you know the reasons why. And we'd like to get, obviously, as high as we can, and also you know the reasons why. The question, of course, is this going to help us get to sort of near atomic resolution? Okay, so here's a typical micrograph of our data. And this is real space, so most of our images are what I call crummy EM because there's very little contrast. Again, you've heard this story. You know the answer to it. Once we digitize and get it into a computer, we can quickly do one thing and stretch the contrast. And immediately you can see that it's not important what the structure is, but some of these particles look very dense and others look very empty. And that's because some of them have DNA inside them and some of them have nothing inside them. And also, if you sit and stare at individual images, like, for example, that one, you can look at it as long as you like, and you can say, oh, I see some information, some detail there, but you're gonna be hard-pressed to say that the thing that encapsulates that this looks like that. And in fact, whether it's full or empty, it has this sort of capsid on the outside. So my goal is to tell you a little bit about basically how do we go from a micrograph to that 3D structure. And of course, you're all wondering, how do you do that, right? That's the important thing. We've got a micrograph now of these particles suspended in ice over holes, low dose, etc. And the question is, how do we get to this beautiful 3D structure that tells us something about how viruses infect cells? Well, here it is. Here's a very schematic, watered-down flow chart of what we do. And I know it's already late, and you guys are worried about getting to the beach and lunch and all that sort of stuff. So this is what you're actually hoping I'm going to talk about, okay? And yeah, I know the gory details occur inside that black box, and I'm going to make it very clear to you that I tend to worry what goes on inside that black box. Maybe you don't, because you never know what lurks inside these black boxes. And in fact, it may be even at the surface, as you get just below the skin of the black box, you worry about, you know, what's going on inside that black box. But if you dig really deep, I'm afraid you'd really worry a lot.
Don't make me come up there.
I have a 100 milliwatt laser. I'll post that. All right, so here's a flow chart. And again, you're going to all run for the exits, but I'm going to sort of take you through this process, and just to give you an idea of what we do. So this is just a flow chart, starting at the top, digitize the micrograph, work our way through. We eventually say, are we done? Done making a structure, and we want to visualize and interpret it. Again, you're going to hear more talks. You heard Waz talk. Wonderful. And then I guess we will hear a little bit about archiving the data as well. So these are very important parts of the whole process, but I'm not going to say anything more about them today. I'm going to talk about the guts here. I want to point out that, in fact, this doesn't happen with one single program. It takes a variety of programs. The one in red are ones that we've developed over the years, and the ones in, I guess that's kind of a bluish cyan or whatever, are commercial programs that we need, for example, to digitize the micrograph. And there's a whole variety of really beautiful visualization tools that are being used now and developed, and we're sort of getting out of the business of that. There's many, many people out there who know how to do it better than we do. But just to give you an idea that there's several programs that one has to deal with, and that gets to be somewhat cumbersome, especially for somebody who's new. They have to sort of work their way through and know how to run these programs. The heart and soul of this whole process actually occurs in this region here and involves these programs. And again, I may not have time to, so I'm just going to say right now that we now, in fact, Xiaodong, who's here, and I think we'll demonstrate this in the practical, has taken the entire guts and automated it into a program he calls Auto 3D EM, which takes a lot of the toil out of it, but it does make this thing into a black box, which I always worry about. So I want to tell you more about the gory details of what's inside the black box, but because for those of you who actually want to do this, I think you really need to know what's going on. And I think that would be true of anybody who gets up here and talks about whatever kind of processing. You really do need to know what's going on in order to know that at the end of the day, you've got something that's meaningful. So let's start at the top. I'm not going to have to say too much because you've all seen this. So at the very beginning, we digitize our micrograph. We box particles. So this is just an illustration. And we have two ways to do it. We can do it manually or semi-automatically. But basically, the procedure is to find a particle, expand the size of your window. In our case, we've got spherical particles. So in cross-section, they're circular. So it's easy to put a circular window around it. Make sure it's big enough to capture that particle. We basically stamp that data out of the digital micrograph and write it out as a file. And there's only three of those such particles in here, so we would basically stamp out three of those, shown here. So we extract the data contained within a square box, write it out to a file. In our case, we write all of the particles from a micrograph to one file, just for bookkeeping purposes. And now David mentioned this, and I'm glad he did. The first thing you do is, in fact, remove this stuff around the corners here, because you don't really want that. That's not part of the particle, so you might as well remove some noise. So we just basically mask the particle, and you have something that looks like this. But then you have to do a thing called floating. Again, David mentioned that if you take the average value around the outside, okay, and set all the values around the particle to be that value, that's a thing called floating, and that makes it look like this. And so certainly to most of you, it looks like the particle is now sort of floating in a sea of density, which is about the same as the particle itself. Whereas here, it's very obvious to all of you that the particle is sort of floating in a sea that has quite a bit different density value. I'll sort of illustrate why this is important. And then David also mentioned this process of apodization, which is basically just taking the edges and making them a little bit soft. So if you look at the edge up here, this is just a floated and then apodized. It just softens those edges, okay? And so that's what we do. We extract, we mask, we float, and we apodize. That becomes our data now. And so let's look at what the Fourier transform. The Fourier transforms, even for single particles, which produces a molecular transform, not a sample transform like in the helices and the 2D crystals, it's kind of a mess. But notice that the Fourier transform of this, it's just a square mask and unfloated. The strongest feature in the Fourier transform is this sine x over x in the x and y directions. And why is that? Everybody chime in. You got the square box, which is, you know, it's very obvious. It's high contrast. So it's most of this, the highest power in this transform is the transform of the box. And that's not something you're interested in. You don't care about the box. You care about the particle. All right, so you might say, well, let's make a circular mask. That helps a little bit. It gets rid of this spike, but what does it do? Remember the guy looking at the sphere? Look at the transform of the sphere. What's the transform of a sphere? It's an airy disk, a series of disks, a central disk with rings around it. So basically what you see here is the strongest part of this transform is just the transform coming from that circle, the mask again. Now if you float it, look what happens. All of a sudden, the molecular transform sort of pops out at you. And that's what you really want. You don't care about the Fourier transform of the mask. You want the Fourier transform of the particle. Now, this is just the floated one. If I apodize it, you'll see slight changes going on in the background, but it's not a big effect. Whoops. So you can't see a big effect, but we believe that by apodizing, we remove a little bit of the so-called noise that's generated by having a sharp edge here. Okay, so this is the kind of data that we look at. And here you go. Here's the molecular transform of that one particle. Again, you can look at it and you say, oh my God, what am I supposed to do with that? I don't see spots. I don't see layer lines. David? Better be a good one.
You have to take a box that's bigger than the particle if you haven't corrected for it.
Yeah, sure. You have to go far enough out. Okay, so I'll say, yeah, okay, because the images that we take are generally at high defocus, okay, and the contrast transfer function is going through lots of zeros, what effectively that does is it produces around any strong feature, in fact, around any feature, these what are called Fresnel fringes, little fringes that emanate out from the particle, emanate outwards from the edge into this region here. And if you don't correct for the CTF before you do your boxing and you do these kind of operations, you're going to be cutting off those high-frequency ripples that you need to get high-resolution information. So it's a warning, and you should ask the people in your practicals, what exactly does that mean? Because it would take a little bit while to go into the details of it, but it's one of these things I'm sweeping under the rug at the moment. Okay, but David's right for pointing it out. Yeah?
When you apodize, what kind of width in terms of pixels are you using to do that?
Yeah, we can choose that, but generally we can set it to anything we want, but we generally choose about 4 or 5 pixels, so it falls off as a Gaussian or however you want to do it. Okay, so then we've boxed out from one micrograph, in this case, I don't know, 40 or 50 particles, and here they are represented in a program that the people in the practical will get to use, I hope, Kelly, maybe, Rob EM, and it allows you to do a lot of manipulation in the processing here. So here's a gallery of the ones we've just basically plucked out, and these, in fact, are masked and floated and apodized. Okay, so then there's this business where you've just boxed the particles, but there's a certain amount of pre-processing that we do. And I think, again, everybody probably does this in one form or another. In the case of our pre-processing, we can do several things. We can remove blemishes. We can remove background gradients. We can normalize what are called normalized means and variances. We can apodize. We can determine CTF parameters. And we can create what are called these initial parameter files. And I'll just illustrate a few of these things here. So the first thing, for example, remove the gradient. I can't remember who mentioned this, but it was important, and I'm glad they did. If you notice over this field here, the ice is a little bit thinner here. It's a little bit thicker by the carbon film. So you don't have a uniform thickness of ice. So the particles up here have a denser background than the ones down here. And in fact, because it's getting thinner and thinner as you go here, there's actually a gradient even across each particle. And this can create all kinds of problems with trying to determine origins and other things. So we want to remove those gradients before we go on further processing. So we have this little button up here that says manipulate, and a whole bunch of things, most of which are turned off for the purposes of studying this type of data. And one of them here says, where is it? Linear gradient. You choose that, you hit it, and voila, it removes that gradient, okay? I'm not going to tell you how we do this. We can go over that later if you want. But basically, we've now removed the gradient, and then when we've done that, you can't really see much in terms of the raw data. It's very hard to see that because for each particle there's a slight gradient, so you don't really see much difference there. So the next thing we're going to do is a thing called normalized means and variances. Go back up to manipulate, and anything that we manipulate will happen to all of the images. In the old days, we used to do this file by file. It's very painful. So we come down here, we say normalize means and variances. And there we just did it. All right, so compare it before and after. And you can see immediately what we've done is basically made all the particles float in the same sea, the same background. The other thing we've done, which is very hard for you to see, is that there's a statistical variation in each image. And we've normalized that so they all have about the same variation. And I know the experts are saying, you can't do that, you can't do that. This is for one micrograph. Okay, so we expect at least on this one micrograph that these particles ought to pretty much have about the same variation and the same background now. So now it's getting harder and harder to see the particles. This apodization, I've already talked about that. So basically this whole process can occur very quickly on all your particles. You know, if you have 500, it will happen in literally seconds on all of them at once. Next thing we do is we try to determine, you know, what was the defocus level for that particular micrograph. And so here's a different set of data, a smaller set of data. What we can do is say, let's take that data, go to this FFT menu item. It opens up this window here, and it shows us the FFT of the first particle up here by default. So that's the FFT of that particle is shown right here. And in fact, this one already, you can start to see a little bit of the CTF from that one particle. But generally speaking, from one particle, there's not enough signal to see the contrast transfer function. So we have a little button down here which says average the FFTs. We do an incoherent average of all of the FFTs of each of those individual particles, and you'll notice you hit that button, and boom, that's the average FFT of all of those, I don't know, those 40 or 50 particles. And now you can clearly see the tone rings, okay? So that's a start. At least you can see what the transfer function is for that particular micrograph. And then we have a region over here that allows us to basically pick two points. We're trying to pick two nodes. We did a pretty lousy job here for the purposes of illustration. So the green button was, you know, you pick one node, one region of the node, sorry, one node position, which is the black part here, and then you pick some area about 90 degrees away just to get the program started. And it immediately then tries to, it makes a guess. It says, well, if that's where the first node is, then that's what the first node of the CTF looks like, and then here would be the additional rings that would be generated if that was correct. We have another button over here which allows us to refine that, let the computer refine that. You can fine-tune it yourself by hand, but you learn pretty quickly that it's not worth doing that. Let the computer do it for you, and then you check and see if you agree with the computer. So you hit this little button over here. It opens up another window. Let's not worry about what's in that window. It says estimate the defocus and iterate that process 10 times. And when you do that, okay, you see it picks up where the real nodes are, and it then shows you, you know, where it thinks the nodes, the additional nodes are, and you can override that. You can also pick the second node if you want. You don't have to pick the first one. Anyway, you can basically flicker back and forth, which helps you see, you know, just how well is the program doing in terms of picking out where those nodes are. And the whole value of that is it comes back and it'll tell you over here, it'll tell you that in one direction the defocus is 2.2 microns, and the other direction is also 2.2, because this is a fairly stigmated image. But this will also look for astigmatism as well. And that, of course, is important because you have to then say to the programs that are going to put this together into a 3D structure that if you want to correct for the CTF, it has to know for every particle what the defocus value was. Okay, so now you're done pre-processing. Well, you're almost done.
What you're really looking at, from my estimate, is the minimum of density there, right? I mean, you call those nodes.
Basically, you're looking at the square of the Fourier transform of all those particles, and so where it's a minimum is where you'd be at a node or zero of the CTF. Wherever you see a peak, it's either positive or negative peak in the CTF. Okay, so before you get started with the heart and soul of the processing, you have to make some decisions about, you know, how much resolution do I think I have to get started with this process. You can't just say, oh, I've got 4 angstrom data, let's just jump right in and start processing at 4 angstroms. It virtually never works that way. So you start this process by being realistic and saying, let's start out at low resolution, try and get a low resolution structure, see if it looks okay, and then we'll bootstrap our way to higher resolution. This is pretty much the standard procedure. And then what we're going to do is determine the origin and orientation for every single particle. And the goal is to determine where the phase origin of each particle is and what particular view that particle was in when it was recorded in the microscope. And one can always argue, is this the most important step? And I certainly think it certainly is, because like anything else, if you get this wrong, you can guarantee that what comes out the other end is going to be wrong. That's not to say that the other parts are not important as well. I mean, you know, if you make mistakes, like David pointed out, if you mask too tight, you can actually cut off high-resolution details, and that will never appear in your reconstruction. So you've got to be careful at each step. But this is certainly very important, and it's the same sort of thing throughout anyone else's processing. And so it basically boils down to this. It's basically that you have many different views of objects, which I said before, you assume they have the same structure, but they just happen to be viewed in different orientations. Same structure, but just viewed in different orientations. And so you have to solve that problem. What is the orientation of this particle? That one. Each one has to be solved. So first I have to say a few words about our conventions. The convention is to take an icosahedron and place it so that three mutually perpendicular twofold axes, where these edges are, align along a Cartesian XYZ coordinate frame. And then to define the view orientation for any particle, we look in the XZ plane, and we measure the angle theta starting from Z moving towards X in the XZ plane. And then we switch to the XY plane, and we measure the angle phi starting from X and moving towards Y. Okay? If you remember, so if we use that convention, then just looking at theta and phi, we have three angles that we have to define. But the first two, theta and phi, the z-axis would then be defined 0, 0. 0 theta, 0 degrees phi. The x-axis would be 90 degrees theta and 0 degrees in phi. Y would be 90 degrees and 90. Okay? So we can use this system to define where anything is in that icosahedron. But we really only care about the asymmetric unit. We want to solve the structure of the asymmetric unit, so we basically only need to look in terms of view orientations within this asymmetric unit, because any other view can be, because of the symmetry, folded back into this asymmetric unit. And this is defined by two five-folds and a three-fold here. And so just an arbitrary example here is if the angle is actually 80 degrees theta, so you come down 80 degrees, and you rotate minus 15 and phi, you rotate it back a little bit, you'd be over in that part of the asymmetric unit. But you will have now defined the view orientation if you happen to be looking along that direction at this icosahedron. That defines the view orientation of that particle, but you're still missing one thing, and that is, you can imagine that if you're looking down that direction, you might be looking at it, say, like this, but you don't know how it's turned this way. That's the omega angle. So you need those three angles to specify completely what the orientation of that particle is, and that's illustrated here. The angle around that view direction is omega. And this is just an illustration. If we take an old reconstruction that we had, bovine papillomavirus, and we reproject that structure. Now, this is a reconstruction, so the signal-to-noise is quite high. If you reproject it down all different directions within that asymmetric unit, so for example, here along a threefold direction, or here along a twofold direction, or here along a fivefold, or here along the other fivefold, you notice that if you look carefully at these particles, they all have a slightly different appearance, because as they're turned in the microscope, they're going to look a little bit different. And I think in the next slide, there's a certain redundancy here, which I'm not going to get into now, but if we just look at half the asymmetric unit, I think at this level you can see more clearly. So you can see there's a twofold axis of symmetry there. You rotate that particle by 180 degrees, it looks the same as it did before. You rotate that one by 120 degrees, it looks the same as it did before. This one by 72 degrees, although we're not exactly on a fivefold axis there, but it's almost, you get the same particle. Whereas these other ones, you know, you don't basically see any way to rotate it and get the same structure again, because you're not looking down a symmetry axis, you're looking somewhere else. But we can say that this particle here, for example, is theta 81 and phi 18. That set of angles defines that characteristic appearance of that structure. This is noise-free data, though, so it's easy to do for this type of structure. Also, all of these are shown with the omega angle of 0. Okay. So the question is, how do we determine these values? And we'll see how quickly I can get through this part of it, because this is the nuts and bolts of trying to tell you about this common lines procedure. There's basically two ways to do it. The first thing is, the classical way to do it is using this thing called common lines. And again, historically, this is if you have a brand new structure, you don't know what the structure is, you don't have an idea of what the structure is, this is a tried and true method to get to the answer. The other involves using some kind of a model, so it's so-called model-based, or other people will use the term template matching procedure. So if you have some idea what the structure is, you can use that model as a way to bootstrap your way to the correct structure, as long as you're careful. So in general, if you have some idea what the structure is, or you can generate a crude model, it actually significantly speeds up the process of making this determination. But the students are here to learn, so I want to give you some of the details of exactly how the pioneers in this field figure this problem out, because it really is very clever. So how do we determine the... Okay, so I forgot about this. Another way of calling common lines is a number of what are called ab initio techniques for starting out with a new structure. And I call the second one by guess and by golly, which is the model-based method. Okay, and I'm also going to maybe tell you, I can't prove this today, but certainly people in the practical can ask me and the other instructors about this. It actually turns out that quite often we can use a pretty lousy model and still get the thing to work. I think that's just because with experience we've learned that you don't have to have such a good model to get started. It's amazing, in fact, how bad the models can be and the thing still works. Okay, but common lines. So, you know, these are just wonderful papers to go back and read. I mean, they're just tremendous. There's a tremendous knowledge back that one can gain by going back and reading the old literature. And I'm going to, rather than me try and tell you what common lines are, I'm going to let Tony tell you what common lines are. Okay, so these are quotes from this paper. And just hang in there for a second, okay? So common lines arise as follows. An observed section of the transform intersects an identical symmetry-related section in a line, along which the transform must have the same value in both sections. The common line lies in the original section. However, regarded as line in the symmetry-related section, it must have been generated by the symmetry operation from some other line in the original section. Isn't that easy? Continuing on, we therefore have a pair of lines in the original transform plane along which the transform must have identical values. I can't tell you how many times I reread those back in the early 70s, over and over and over, until I actually met Tony Crowther and had him explain to me. But believe me, what is written here is absolutely correct. I don't know how anyone could write it more succinctly than he did. It's not that easy to understand at first, but it's absolutely true. Everything that I've read to you is true. I'm going to try and prove that to you now. Oh, I forgot some more. A similar pair of lines will be generated by each possible choice of pairs of symmetry operations. The angular positions of these lines are dependent on the orientation of the particle. All right, so let me try and explain it to you. I'll try. Here's your 3D object. From that, you get projections along certain directions. It's a 2D projection. We've all heard about Fourier transforms. All right, here's the 2D Fourier transform of that. And contained in that Fourier transform is what we want to get out. That is, we can't tell by looking at that with our eyes that it's that angle. Again, just a quick aside. In the early days, when they were looking at negatively stained particles, it was actually possible for some of these structures, if you could see the structure and see a threefold axis or a fivefold axis, yes, you can do it with your eyes. But those are about the only ones you could do. You could see sort of, yeah, there's a threefoldness to that view, so therefore it must be along theta 69.09, phi equals 0. Or it looks kind of fivefold, so it must be theta equals 90, phi equals 31.717174. degrees, okay? But you can only do that if you're lucky, and you can't do it with cryo. You'd have to be even more lucky with cryo specimens. But contained in that, according to the Bible, according to Tony, is the information. So if we just represent this Fourier transform, which is just a two-dimensional slice through the three-dimensional Fourier transform, right? You've heard this. We represent it here in some non-rational view. In this case, we're looking at the coordinate frame here. Z is coming out at u, y, and x. And so this is just tipped out of the plane. And this just represents this here, okay? So a simple object here is going to be an object with just a single threefold axis of symmetry. Not an icosahedron, just an object that has just a threefold axis of symmetry. And if you want to see the details, actually Moody has a beautiful job of describing what common lines are. So here's this plane through three-dimensional Fourier space that cuts not along x, y, or z. It just sort of cuts through at some angle. And so it's defined by A, B, C, D, Okay, it's not viewed along any axis of symmetry, but we're going to assume that, in fact, z is equivalent to a threefold axis of symmetry. But this is not a view of a particle with a threefold axis, it's some different direction. So we let the z-axis coincide with the threefold axis, and we operate on that with a threefold symmetry. Because remember, I think David and other people have told you that, in fact, if a structure has symmetry, then there are going to be other transforms that are related to that other transform. Just if you rotate the particle, for example, by the symmetry axis, you'll get another transform which is related to the one that you started with, but it's the same. So basically, we know we have the same transform if we're looking down this direction here. We rotate this by 120 degrees. We generate another transform view, A prime, B prime, C prime, D prime, which is identical to the red one, but just rotated by this threefold axis here. Okay? Now notice that these two planes cross along a line. And that must be a common line. That is, the value of the data along that line as it lies in the red plane is the same as the one in this one. Why is that? Okay, so both planes have common values along the line 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Let's pull this thing apart. We'll pull this thing and put it over here, A, B, C, D. Here's that line, 1, 2, 3. We take this one, pull it out, and turn it around so that it's lined up exactly like this one, because these are identical transforms. They're absolutely the same data. But yet, if we look at where the line goes here, it starts over here, 1, 2, 3. And in fact, because you see them put together here, they have to have the same values, the same amplitudes and phases, whatever it is, along that line. So that means that the data along that line and along that line are the same. But in fact, if you take this one and lay it, I guess here underneath, take this one and lay it on top of that one, you notice that there are two lines. They also both have the same data, the same amplitudes and phases along them. As you go, if you start up here and move along, the same data should be along here. But this is all contained within one transform. So within that one transform, you actually have information that tells you about where the symmetry axis is. And that's because you have, what I've demonstrated here is one pair of common lines. So if we look at the original transform, and we'll use this as an example, we draw a line through there, through this messy thing where you've got amplitudes and phases that we can measure along there. But we also say that from this other one, the symmetry-related one, it must have the same values along that direction. So there it is. So what we do, all right, so this is an easy example. It's just a single threefold axis. The question is, what happens if we have all these other axes of symmetry? So I'm just going to throw this out there. The students can get me to prove it later if you want, not today. If you look at each of the fivefolds in the same way that I just did with the threefolds, you actually generate 12 pairs of common lines for each fivefold. Sorry, there's 12 fivefolds, but there's a twofold redundancy because the axis along a fivefold is the same whether you look at it from either direction through the particle. And there's two pairs of common lines for each fivefold view, so you end up with 12 pairs. For the threefolds, there's 20 threefolds, but there's really only 10 threefold axes. They each generate one pair of common lines, like I just showed you. So there's 10 pairs in a whole icosahedron. For the twofolds, it's kind of a special case. There's 30 edges. There's basically 15 twofold axes. They each generate what's called a common line along which the data must be real. And so you have a total of 37 common lines for any view of an icosahedral particle. What does that tell you? Well, if we look at the asymmetric unit of an icosahedron from fivefold, fivefold to threefold, and we look at the sort of constellation of pairs of common lines that you would generate for different views, they kind of look like this. So they're different. If you're near an axis of symmetry, they look sort of degenerate. There's not very many. There don't appear to be very many common lines. But in views that are not along an axis of symmetry, in fact, the common lines sort of fan out, and they produce something that looks. So, for example, if you're looking down a threefold axis, this is what the set of common lines, those 37 pairs, would look like. Some of them collapse on top of each other. Here's one that's at direction 80, 11, and it looks quite complicated. Here's one just 1 degree off of a twofold axis, and it looks like a lot of the pairs are coming together. So let's look at this example, because this is one of these, this is a little bit easier, because in fact, at this particular angle, the common lines spread out pretty nicely. Again, you don't know from this which ones are each of the pairs. Where's the pair 1, pair 2, pair 3, pair 37? We can write that out. And I'm just going to illustrate taking that set of common lines and saying, here's the Fourier transform of an unknown of an object that I've recorded in the microscope. I have no idea what its orientation is. But let's just guess. Maybe it's 8011. Is it 8011? If it's 8011, we can tell the computer to set out that set of common lines the way it exists for that particular view orientation. And I'm just going to just sort of make this up here. We'll say, let's pretend that this is common line pair 1. So we think that those two lines should have the same values. That's for a perfect object, an object that has perfect icosahedral symmetry, no noise. And just for argument's sake, we'll call that pair 2. And there's going to be 37 of these. And we're going to basically say to the computer, okay, let's make our first guess. We think that the particle that was viewed in the microscope is viewed at orientation 80, 11, and 0. Let's test for that. So what we do is we actually look at the phases and amplitudes along that line and along that line and see if they agree. We do that for all 37 pairs. We write that number down. If we happen to have it right, that number should be a small number. Okay? Because if everything agrees along here and you do, say, a difference between what's along this line and what's along that line, if they're the same, you get a zero. Okay? And hopefully if this is perfect data, that would be true for all 37 pairs. But of course, you know, that's just a guess. We don't know that. So if we then go to and say, well, what about 8011.1? Maybe it's 8011.1. Maybe it's rotated 1 degree in omega. And all I did there was just take that entire constellation and just rotate it by 1 degree. Do the same test. Okay, 1 degree, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees, 5, 10, 15, 30. We go all the way around making all those tests. Okay, we only actually have to go halfway around. We basically make, say, 180 tests, assuming that this is the view orientation, but we don't know what the omega is. We write down all those numbers, and the computer is going to give us an answer. Okay, and the metric that we use is to look for the lowest phase residual based on all of those different attempts that we made. And you're going to repeat this process for all possible theta, phi, and omega orientations. So David just gave you an example whereby you really only have to know two layer lines, and if you get them right, you're done. In this case, it takes literally 250,000 of these kinds of combinations, guesses, to come up with the best possible guess. Obviously, you can't do it by eye, and the computer just sort of brute forces through this process. In this case, this is for 1 degree angular orientations. If you went to more coarse, you wouldn't need so many, but then you might miss the right orientation. If you go finer than that, you're going to be using supercomputers and wasting a lot of computer time. Nonetheless, you're letting the computer just sort of brute force through and say, you know, which one is the right answer? And at the end of the day, it comes up, it gives you an idea and says, this is what I think the answer is. So you get theta, phi, and omega from that. So that becomes at least your first guess as to what the orientation is for that particular particular particle. The common lines procedures are also used to determine the phase origin, but I'm going to spare you the details on that one. So remember I told you there's two methods to do this. The first one is this method, tried and true, and the second one was this model-based template matching. In fact, most of the structures, not just icosahedral, but you name it, whatever you're looking at, you've heard examples of this already, that people, if they have some kind of a model, they use this model-based approach to try and solve the problem of, you know, what's my orientation and what's my origin. They're very, very powerful, and they've been around now for close to 10 years, I think, and sort of everybody's doing it. And again, the details of that can be discussed in the practical session. Let me just indicate to you this one program that we use to do this. Again, it could take another lecture on itself just to illustrate how we can start with a model and somehow generate from that theta, phi, omega, and xy values for each one of our stack of images. Okay, so we have the programs to do this, but again, I'm not going to tell you how we do it here. At the end of the day, you come out with a text file that has a list of IDs. So in this particular example, let's say we had 27 particles. So for each one of those particles, we have a theta value, a phi value, and an omega value. So for particle 1, the computer thinks it's viewed along direction 80 minus 13, 313. It also thinks the origin within the box is at 48.751 in x and 48.849 pixels in y. So it gives you the best guess for each one of those particles. It also gives you some metrics that I'll come back to in a minute. I'm not going to these other columns here help you decide whether a particle is good or bad. And that is in terms of you know that you don't necessarily have 100% good data, and you want to basically try and weed out the bad ones so that when you make a reconstruction, you're not putting in bad data. Garbage in, garbage out, right? So we want to weed out the bad images before you compute the 3D reconstruction. And we have basically three different measures. It's not important exactly what they are. They're different kinds of correlation coefficients. If you just look at some numbers, for example, here, particle 12, particle 19, they have what's called a PFT-CC correlation coefficient of 0.784, 0.775. And here's two particles here. We color red, 16 and 26, which have lower PFT-CC. So I'm just going to tell you that the higher the PFT-CC, the more that particular particle agrees with the model that you have, the reconstruction. And so the question is, do I throw those out or not? And this is always a big question. One way we can do that, in this case there were 60 particles, we can say what's the average coefficient, 0.679, standard deviation of 0.075, and again, we can set to whatever level we want. Typically, I think we go one standard deviation below the mean and throw any data out below that, just for the purposes of creating a model, creating a reconstruction from it. So once we've selected the images that we think are good images, we compute the three-dimensional reconstruction. And so we only combine the good images to compute that map. Again, I'm surprised we haven't seen this slide yet. This goes back to a paper by Jim Lake back in the early 70s, the famous duck. You all now know, you've heard it. If you know the structure already, you can compute its three-dimensional Fourier transform. If you happen to know its three-dimensional Fourier transform, you can mathematically compute what structure gave rise to that. And so the process is that we don't have the three-dimensional structure. So this is the Yogi Berra. In theory, everything's easy. But in practice, it doesn't work, right? What we have in practice are two-dimensional projected views in different directions of the three-dimensional object. From that, we create two-dimensional transforms, which must be central sections. Each one of these is a central section of the three-dimensional transform. The question is, how do you put those back in? And again, that's the key. The key is you have to know the orientation of each of these images to know how to put those back together to create a three-dimensional transform. But assuming you can do that along the lines that I just mentioned, you create, by using enough images, a three-dimensional transform. You back transform for that, do the inverse Fourier transform, and you generate a density distribution within your box, and that's the duck. And the overall scheme, and again, I assume David was going to tell you this, but you start with the Fourier transform, you calculate big G's, from those big G's you calculate little G's, from those little G's you calculate the density function. It's the same kind of mathematics that David sort of led you up to and said read the papers. So I'll do the same right here. It's a process that once you've got the three-dimensional transform, you can work your way back towards the density function. And so the steps are, basically you compute the 2D Fourier transform of each particle image, you combine all of those 2D FFTs, once you know how to put them together, into a transform here. In our case, we create a three-dimensional transform which is along annuli, along planes, and it's divided up into these circular rings, these annuli, so you have several annuli on each plane. You put together a three-dimensional transform, remembering that for any particular view, because of the icosahedral symmetry, you actually generate 60 total views, 60 total transforms to fill in Fourier space. So even just one transform fills in a lot of Fourier space. Okay? But there are some positions in Fourier space that don't get filled in very well, and that's why you need more and more images. You compute these big... Yeah?
When you have the orientation data,
Yes.
It would help with the step.
Yes.
Can you actually evaluate the data set at that point?
We do, yeah. I think I give an example of that here, just a graphical example of that. So again, I'm not going to go to the mathematics. We compute the big G's along each of those annuli. We compute the little G's for those big G's using this Fourier-Bessel transform relationship. And from that, we calculate the map in polar space. So it's a map which is a function of radius, phi angle, and z. And from that, we then convert it to a Cartesian map that we can use in all our visualization programs. So we've got the first reconstruction. And again, I'm not going to sort of sweep this under the rug right now, but we can choose a couple different places to correct for the CTF effects to make sure that, in fact, we do things right and make those corrections properly. Then the question becomes, well, how do you know how good that structure is? So the goal is to assess the resolution of the density map to determine, what do I do next? Am I done? Do I go on? What do I do? And again, everybody does this in different ways. So to monitor the quality, one way to do this is sort of the semi-tried and true method, but it has some flaws built into it. Nonetheless, we take that set of images that we had, and we divide them into an even set and an odd set. So if we had 100 particles, we take 50 and set them aside, and take the other 50 and set them aside. And we basically compute two different maps, an even map and an odd map. And then we do some masking, which means basically here's a cross-section through a reovirus map at about, I think, 8 angstroms, and it's unmasked. But we realize that there's some data on the inside, which is not icosahedrally ordered, and so we don't really care about that. There's also a lot of data on the outside that we know is outside the particle, so we're going to get rid of that. So we mask that, basically just get rid of the data between those two radii, outside of those two radii. And we do that for each of these two 3D reconstructions, and we basically compute from that structure factors. Okay, so we basically Fourier transform that masked map. We Fourier transform that masked reconstruction. And from that, we can compare these structure factors and plot out the phase differences and correlation coefficients as a function of spatial frequency. So if we do this for the unmasked maps, even and odd, we get a curve that looks something like this. And it looks like if we use this threshold, which again, this is something we can argue about, if we use a 0.5 threshold, it looks like the resolution is about 8.7 angstroms. If we mask the data and just look at the data that we really believe is most icosahedrally ordered, which is what we care about here, and there's several proteins that make up this capsid shell, the resolution value we get out here is slightly higher. And I also agree with Thomas Waltz when he says that it's just a number, okay? It is just a number, and we really care more about what we actually see. How does it actually, I mean, is it meaningful? But we do know that we can actually get better numbers. Do we get better data by doing this sort of thing? At least it gives us some metric to decide whether we should stop or move on. We also have found, and other people have done this too, is that the 3D density map is not completely equally resolved in all places. So, for example, if we look at this map and look at it at say, a sort of what we do is we calculate resolution as a function of radius. Okay, and we actually see that from all the way from 245 angstroms out to 363 angstroms, the actual by these criteria, the resolution is slightly better than 7 angstroms. But if we move to higher radii, from 235 and lower, 235 to 380, then all the data within there at least is better than 8 angstroms resolution. But basically what this says is that you get further and further out, the resolution is actually deteriorating. So the resolution is not totally isotropic throughout the structure. And this can also be important in terms of interpreting details. You may be less able to interpret things reliably way out here or inside here. So you have to have some idea of just how reliable your data is. Monitor data quality. Okay, so one of the things that we can do with these programs is go back and look at our raw data and do some particle processing. So this might help answer some of your question, Trevor. This is hard to see, but unfortunately, but these little red crosses show us where each one of these particles it lands within the asymmetric unit. And just a quick glance at that lets you know whether or not you get an even distribution. There are other kinds of metrics metrics that tell us whether we've got a nice uniform distribution. If you don't, if all the views are along a threefold or a fivefold, you're dead. This gives you sort of a quick idea of it. The program is also useful because you can pick out a particular particle, click on it, and it will show you that particle up here, and it'll give you data about that particular particle, you know, what the view orientation is. And you can also take the model, the current model that you have, and project it along that direction and compare it to that image. Again, this comes back from the old days when people didn't trust their programs, I guess, and wanted to see, is this model consistent with my data? You can do this for maybe hundreds of particles, but you're not going to be able to do it when we get up to 10,000 or 100,000 particles. We'll have to have other methods to sort of do the same thing for us and make some decisions about, well, that image doesn't really agree with that model, so you better flag it and maybe look at it more carefully. So you can sort of move around and look at different particles to see how well, you know, the process is going. And so you make some decisions, and you ask the question, am I done? Okay. Normally, you're not done at the beginning, so you say, okay, do I want to refine? Usually, that's the first thing you want to do. And so you go back up here, and you may want to refine the CTF parameters, for example. You go back up here, and you say, all right, maybe I've achieved 10 angstroms resolution at this point, and I want to try and go to slightly higher resolutions. So you tell the programs, you know, try 9.5 angstroms and see if you can eke out 9.5 angstrom data from this current set of particles. And so you go around and around until perhaps by selecting better images, computing new models, using those models to help you refine, you slowly get to a better point. And eventually, it just doesn't go anywhere with that set of images. And so you finally say, well, I'm not done yet. I'd like to try something else. But I'm done refining for the moment. So do we want to add some more data in? And typically the answer might be yes. So you expand the data set, you add in a second micrograph, a third micrograph, a hundredth micrograph, whatever. And you go through this process again until you finally say, well, no, it may be that I'm not done yet, I want to try some other things. So for example, you might say, oh my God, I masked all my particles too tight. I'm cutting off resolution. So we can automatically go back and re-box all of our data, basically with a push of the button, and just expand the box and start all over again. Actually, you don't have to start all over again. You still have a good model, but you just compute a new reconstruction. It's slightly bigger, slightly more pixels. So we're getting close. I think we're getting real close. Again, at some point you finally say, I give up. You know, uncle, I'm done. I want to go look at what I've got. Of course, you all realize that most of the time we sneak a peek and want to look at and start trying to interpret our structures. In fact, most of our collaborators, of course, want to jump on this bandwagon the first time we come up with a reconstruction, and they don't really care so much about all this refinement that we do. And then it's also important, so that the rest of the world can benefit from your labor, to have a way to archive that data. Okay, so I guess I will ask the organizers if they want to give me another 5 minutes or if I just stop here. I think I can go. Okay. So I'll just say a few things here. So pretty much what I've told you so far is sort of the tried and true methods that we use. And I just want to make a few comments. Okay. So for many years, most of these programs were run by hand. You know, this program creates an answer, and you take the data input from that program, the data output from that program, you send it to the next one. You sort of work your way through this process. And so refinement becomes very tedious, and adding more data becomes very tedious. So it's no different from anybody else in the back row there that deals with more and more data. You're stuck with a couple choices. One is to create new algorithms. Another one is to basically parallelize everything that you did. So, again, I didn't go into the specific programs that we use, but the EM3DR, which produces a 3D reconstruction, the PFT search, which gives you a first guess as to what the orientation is within the asymmetric unit, this program called Orientation and Origin Refinement tries to refine that best guess. These all work in a serial fashion on a single machine. And we've produced in the last several years, parallel versions of this, a parallel 3D art program, and parallel orientation or origin refinement. Does anybody guess why we don't call this POOR? Nobody liked. I said it has to be POOR. It was called POR. So it's not POR. It's POOR. We do both origin and orientation refinement. So we settled on this, PO squared R. The other thing is, of course, this is a big push now in the field is to automate. Human beings can't do all this with 10,000 particles or 100,000 particles. And so we have, which I didn't show you, we have ways to semi-automatically box out those particles, which is reasonably easy to do for spherical particles, but it's not necessarily a slam dunk. So for example, for a given micrograph, it might take a person half an hour to box out 500 or 1,000 particles. We can do that in about 2 seconds with an automated procedure. But most humans don't like the answer that they get out of that because it's not 100% accurate. There's always some bad apples. You have to go in and get rid of them. But nonetheless, as we get to millions of particles or hundreds of thousands, you're going to have to go to some kind of automated processing, picking out particles, and then weeding them out by whatever means you can. Maybe you let some bad particles into the process, but you eventually weed them back out again somewhere else in the pipeline. Again, I mentioned this before, and we'll do this in the practical, but Xiaodong has created this automated origin and orientation refinement. So all that gory detail that I spent the last 45 minutes talking about, that's all now been automated so that all those programs are sort of running under one umbrella and you only have sort of one set of parameters to get the process starting, and you can just say let it go for 10 cycles or let it go for 100 cycles or mail me the results at intermediate time so I can take a check and see how things are going, and if they don't look like they're going well, I can stop the process and restart it in a different way. So it does involve some interaction, but if things are going well, you just let them go. He's got some wonderful examples where, within a day or two, you can go from low resolution to better than, 8.5, 9 angstroms. Just let the process go. The other thing is this thing, I don't know, is Nico in the audience here? There he is, okay. So I'm sure when he heard me talking about determining resolution, he's cringing. But we've realized, and I think a lot of people in the field have realized before, that this process of taking your data set sort of at the end and splitting it in half and then using that as a way to determine resolution has its flaws. They're not independent reconstructions. Their orientations and origins were dependent upon one model being used, the same model. They're not truly independent, but it gives you an idea of how well you're doing. So we also use a process that he has already published, and I think Wei Zheng in Watt's group has done as well, is we divide our image data at the very beginning and basically carry out that entire process independently for two data sets. So we split the data right at the very beginning. And I'll just illustrate that real quickly. The question is, it certainly minimizes, does it eliminate completely the bias that you get in this kind of assessment? We could argue that, but at the end, you end up with two independent reconstructions, and we can basically just combine those two together to get our final reconstruction. When we're finally done, we say we can't get any better resolution. We got these two maps. They agree with one another to some value, and we now want to combine them together to get slightly better signal to noise. And so this is kind of the process. The process is we start at the beginning with our box particles. We split them into an even set, red, or odd set, blue, for example. I'm not going to go through the details. We go through a whole set of cycles of what I call search. Search means try and find the region within the asymmetric unit that's the appropriate region for that particular image. And then you go to a refinement. Okay. So let me just concentrate for a second on this part. So you've seen this before. We digitize, we box, we pre-process, and then we split the data before we do anything else. And we keep this data completely pristine. Okay. We do our orientation searches with a separate model. These are two separate models that we use to get started using a model-based approach. We could use common lines, but it's tedious. What we do is at certain intervals, we just check. We say, well, does this map agree with it, that map? These are independent. We can just check and see. That's just a metric to say, are we done with the process? Is it still converging? Is this one still getting better? Is that one still getting better? If the answer is, generally speaking, no, then we just keep doing this process over here. We keep doing this process over here until these eventually reach a point where they don't get any better, and we say, okay, but they agree, and we're done searching. Then we go into a refinement mode. We can also keep the data split during refinement. And this gives us what I believe is a pretty independent measure of how good the data really is.
Tim,
yeah?
So what kind of differences do you find if you split it up first or split it up later? How much does it shift the
regulation? Zhao Deng might be able to answer that. We don't have too many examples of that so far, but it's not that much different. I mean, we haven't really done this enough times yet to come up with any kind of statistics, but it's not something like, you know, a world of difference. It's just like Xiaodong says, we feel a lot more comfortable. We feel that we're actually giving a value that's meaningful, you know, that really does tell you how good these data agree. Well, I mean, and Nico, I'm sure you may even talk about this, is that there are flaws in the other procedure, so that you're never quite sure. You can't say categorically that this is really the resolution of these maps, because it's not true. I mean, it's biased by the noise. So I guess one thing I'll just throw out here is that, you know, what other sorts of strategies? There's lots of strategies. You know, we could talk about this quite a bit. But one thing is that, you know, we talk a lot about trying to improve resolution by substantially increasing the number of images. Okay, in the ideal world, this is, you know, in theory, this would be perfect. If we had perfect images and we just add many, many more, then eventually we should get to much higher and higher resolution. So if we do that ad infinitum, in theory that might be the right thing to do. But in fact, my question is really, is it that we're just not applying rigorous quality control measures to weed out the bad data? We could actually do better. And the thing that I wanted to add, and many people may know this, is this article that came out last year in Journal of Structural Biology. It sort of points to this problem. And gives us some hope. Basically, this NIH group showed that with the icosahedral core of pyruvate dehydrogenase, viruses aren't the only things that are icosahedral. They showed that with just 9 images, the 9 best images, they could still see alpha helices. It's phenomenal that could be true. Now, we could argue, again, I know the people in the back row probably would like to argue this, but I think this is tantalizing to think about. So here they show a map created. There's a total of 963 particles that they had. If you make the map out of the best 139, or the best 44, or the best 9, you still see these alpha helical tubes of these tubes of density that are interpreted as alpha helices. If you take the worst 138 out of that 963, it's pretty bad. Okay, it's not so good. But anyway, this just tells me that, you know, really we're trying to go from 10,000 to 20,000 to 30,000, whatever. It may be that what we really need to do is to get the best 5,000 out of that 10,000, or the best 5,000 out of that 50,000. I still think you need to collect a lot of data, but then choose the best. Now, the question is, how do you choose the best? That's easier said than answered. So I'm done. Yeah.
In trying to find the common lines, if you look at the phase residual sort of as a surface, how much of a problem is it getting stuck in local minima?
It's a big problem. It's, in fact, the reason why we've moved to model-based approaches. So the best way I can answer this in less than a half an hour is that the thing that I noticed about common lines, which made me move over to develop model-based approaches, is that the common lines is very sensitive to the noise in the data. Now, this process was developed back in the days when there were negatively stained particles, high contrast, and at low resolution. And the methods still work quite well. When we went to cryomicroscopy, basically the noise level was so much worse. Okay, so the signal is so much smaller in any given image. So this business of trying to determine where are the lines that best agree becomes just the problem that you indicate. You're basically in a sea that's very noisy, and you can pick out a minimum. The computer will always find a minimum, but it may not be the true global minimum. And you do get stuck in local minima, and you get wrong answers. And so the reason why we went to model-based approach, and again, talk to in each one of your practicals, talk to your instructors about why people use model-based approaches. But the key thing is that the model has high signal-to-noise. And so you're comparing something that low signal to noise with something that high signal to noise. If you're doing common lines, you're comparing something that low signal to noise to low signal to noise. So you're in trouble. Now the question that is going to come up too is, if the model is crummy or wrong, you're comparing something to something wrong, you may get the wrong answer. What I think we will show to the people in our practical is that, in fact, you can start out with something which is completely random and still get the right answer. But that's a good question, though.
How crude are the models that you get? I mean, where do you get these models? I mean, are they
just make it up? So you can try and make a sophisticated model. Okay, so for example, if we wanted to, with the reovirus case, we have the X-ray structure of the core. We have the X-ray structure of some of the outer capsid proteins. We could build a pseudo-atomic model that has lots and lots of detail and use that to try and refine our data. And that works. It works great because we know that the correlation is very, very high. But you can make very, very simple models. You can make a sphere.
So how would you do that? I mean, how would you get the coordinates of that?
Well, you can make a sphere. It's very simple. You can just generate one in the computer. Just tell it to make a sphere, and then you make projections of the sphere. They all look the same. In our case, just to answer you directly, in our case, let's say we have 100 images. We just assume that the phase origin of each image is right in the center of the box. That's not true. It's not. It's usually a little bit off, but we just make that guess. And then we say, just pick at random a theta and phi and omega. Just pick at random. Go ahead. Pick anything you want. Everyone can take a guess. We'd assign that to each one of those images. Most cases, it's going to be wrong, but okay. You make a reconstruction from that because you've now defined theta, phi, and omega, x, and y for every particle. Well, that reconstruction is going to come out looking pretty much like a sphere. But interestingly enough, that sphere is going to have some information about those images. The density changes as a function of radius. That information will most likely be in there. And again, there's other things that I could talk about at greater length, but I won't. That model looks very, very crude, but it gets you started. You test your images against that model, that sphere, and some will agree better than others. The origin might shift around a little bit. You get a better origin. The next model looks a little bit less like a sphere, and it's a little bit better, and eventually it can converge. What amazes me is that it works. I think David mentioned cylinders for helices.
Yeah, that does that. It is when you have random alignments. They're not. The expectation is they're not going to be uniformly distributed, just like if Tim and I have.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. We don't want to make this sound too easy because it really isn't. In our particular case, we're talking about spherical viruses. It seems to work pretty well. We're not exactly sure yet why. I can make the same kind of arguments that David does. But in our experience, it works pretty darn well. What we're now trying to figure out is how can we get the computer to actually tell us whether we're right or wrong, because we're not always right. We get wrong answers. And we know it because we were doing this with test data. We know it's wrong. You know, well, why did it go wrong? We don't know yet. But if we do it enough times, we get a certain, maybe 20% of them are right. The question is, how do you find those 20% that are right?
Well,
I know it's a much harder problem for single particle, single meaning lower symmetry than an icosahedron. Angstroms. Okay, maybe Xiaodong could answer that. I can answer you from the point of view of about maybe 20 or 30 angstroms. About 10 cycles is usually enough from every test case that we've done, even some very tough ones where the particles are already pretty smooth. In 10 cycles, you can get to a model that actually is useful for refinement. That's what we really worry about, is the model useful for refinement? The other thing I'll point out is that we do this with very little amounts of our data. If we have 10,000 particles, we don't use all 10,000. We use maybe 100. That's enough. Any 100 you want. In about 10 cycles, we can probably tell you with some level of success that model is going to be helpful for refining. To me, refinement is then bring in the other 900 particles and just grind away. But if you have a decent model, then you're off to the races. So, yeah, you're not going to be at 10 angstroms in 10 cycles.
You might have already answered this question. What is the cause of isotropic differences in the resolution of your balance?
That's a good question. What's the cause of not having isotropic resolution? Well, one thing is that in the case of the way we do icosahedral reconstruction, we know that errors still persist along the symmetry axes. I think maybe even Vincennes might have said something about that. Somebody did. But basically, these processes, the 3D reconstruction process, can't get rid of noise everywhere. So we know, for example, in icosahedral reconstruction that the center of the particle is something that you don't put any faith in whatsoever, because that's where all the symmetry axes cross, and so the noise is least averaged out at the center. That's one sort of thing. The other thing is just the structure itself. Generally speaking, we find, and maybe Walk can comment too, that at the very extremes of the structure, which is exposed to solvent, you've got loops, and those might be moving around, and so it doesn't get resolved quite as well. Whereas the part of the capsid that's really tightly locked together, oftentimes, in our case at least, is reasonably high resolution. Well, the examples I'm giving you here, at least in terms of the structure itself, you can't recover if the structure is more flexible in certain regions and not. I don't see any procedure for recovering from that. No, what you say is absolutely true. I'm sort of giving you my experience based on this one structure, reovirus, where we have X-ray data for all the proteins, so we can actually say, we can actually see all 342 helices, all 92 beta sheets that have more than two strands, and so we can actually look at our map in detail and see why it is that certain regions aren't. So at least in that one case, I don't think it's because we haven't refined it well enough. But I mean, you're right. If you don't refine well enough, the farther out in radius you go, the more the error there is. But we can still see all the helices out at the extremes. It's just the density is a little bit lower, indicating that there is some movement actually out there. So no, you're right. I saw. Okay. The question is: does it pay to get a crude model from negative stain? In some cases, absolutely. Yeah. In most of our cases, no. And I guess probably the reason for that is that most viruses are big enough. The smallest ones we've studied are 5 megadaltons or so. Now, if the single particle people, by that I mean they're looking at smaller particles. I think you even heard an example of that last night. You do whatever you can to get going. And I think there's lots of examples where people can't get started with cryo of small complexes. They take one step back and try and get a model from negative stain, and that provides them a way to get started. So absolutely, you do whatever you have to, and I wouldn't completely rule out negative staining.
Yeah. You mentioned moving to higher particle counts. Doesn't that scale is the
the square of n, so you know, get like a twofold improvement. You got to use n squared. And,
everything else being equal, if all your images have about the same amount of noise, then every time you double the number of particles, you should get 1.4 times improvement in signal to noise. But it never quite works out that way. Basically, it seems like we have to go up by orders of magnitude to get these. But I think, again, that's a good thing to sort of discuss, not now, but the whole idea of adding more particles, in theory, should work a lot better than it does. I think, in my own mind, I think it mainly reflects specimen quality and just how identical are your specimens. If the specimens are going through all kinds of different contortions, then you know more data actually looks can create a reconstruction that looks worse.
If you try to get started in negative stain, can you use some of the same modules to help you do the averaging for negative stain, or just some? Are there more classical things that you can do?
You mean use the ones that I've been talking about?
Right.
Yeah, they should work just fine.
Yeah.
In fact, with high contrast, they should work really fine.
In the future, you mentioned parallelization across bigger data sets. And it seems that I have the impression that it's a somewhat straightforward problem because it's a parallel parallel. The new algorithms, where would you think the most improvement could be gained by looking at the technology of the algorithms?
Okay, yeah. Some of them, again, it's the devil is in the details. Some of these things seem embarrassingly parallel, and they are, actually, but other things are not. So the Fourier-Bessel program, we still use the original guts that Tony Crowther gave us, and it's not necessarily that easy to parallelize. So we've actually, the P3DR program, I didn't tell you about this, but that's actually a completely different way of doing things. We do it in Cartesian space. So you get a plane, you know where that plane is, and you replicate it 59 more times, and you fill in a Cartesian three-dimensional transform. Again, you know, actually, if you look at those papers and read them, Tony actually says in those papers, he says, if I could, I'd rather do it with a Cartesian coordinate frame, but the computers back in the early 70s just couldn't possibly handle it, and now they can. The advantage of doing that, again, sort of to answer your question, is that we can relax the symmetries. We also want to solve structures that are not just icosahedral, and we also want to be able to solve structures so that we can actually prove that something's icosahedral, so we don't have to make that assumption. And doing it in a Cartesian frame without all the additional things that Tony had put into the Fourier-Bessel method, which assumes the symmetries, we just started from scratch and said, let's write parallel code that works well for in that way.
Now my question is to Verus. So how do I know from the first beginning that my Verus has a icosahedral symmetry?
No, that's a great question. You don't. So generally speaking, the rule that we've always used is, again, the garbage in, garbage out rule. If you go ahead and try and make a reconstruction assuming icosahedral symmetry, and it doesn't have icosahedral symmetry, you'll get something that just is not interpretable. For example, why? Have you ever gotten a reconstruction of something where you've assumed icosahedral symmetry, and it shows up with a beautiful structure, but it doesn't have icosahedral symmetry? You have? In other words, by enforcing icosahedral symmetry on something that doesn't have it, did you get a structure that looks interpretable? I bet the answer is no, because if you take... Yeah, and I think actually, Kelly, you got a good example, don't you?
I tried, and tried, and tried, and I caused the destruction of the origin.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily a rigorous answer, but I think if you try this with some new structure and you just get what looks like a mess that you can't interpret, that's a good indication that you probably put a symmetry in that doesn't exist. In most cases, you know, when we get it right, you know, you get all kinds of detail and it agrees with our biochemistry and everything else. It makes sense and we proceed forward.
One last question for me.
I just wanted to ask a general question about boxing. So is there a rule of thumb that your box should be a certain percentage of your particle? And if the box is so big that you get neighboring particles in there, is that proton or is that totally accounted for by condensation?
Yeah, there's the rule of thumb, Nico, you actually published the sort of values that you can determine at certainty focus levels. You can actually calculate how far outside the particle you need to go to make sure that you're not cutting off data at a certain spatial frequency. And we sort of use as a rule of thumb, you know, we don't know necessarily that we're going to have 5 angstroms or 4 angstroms. We say, well, man, let's just be bold and assume that it's there. So we actually make sure that we have enough pixels outside the particle so that when we box, we don't lose any information. And the business about other particles, you know, I'm sort of a purist. If I see two particles too close to one another, I just assume not box them. But sometimes you don't have any choice. You've got a specimen which is very expensive. You don't have very much of it. You take whatever you can get. Sometimes they aggregate. And so you can do various kinds of procedures where you mask the particle, includes maybe some other, and you can sort of paint out the other particle. Sort of try and get rid of some of that density that you know doesn't belong to your particle. But that's dangerous. Any of that kind of procedure is dangerous because you're adding something that is going to be averaged out to some extent, but it's creating another kind of noise. If you take a pair so that you at least know where the particle is. If you take it so close to focus you can't see it, you don't know where to box it. Yeah.
Was there another question? Stoichiometric labeling.
Right.
So there, in fact, there's a couple papers now, some coming out of
houses.
Oh, that's great.
Where if they have even 50% occupancy or 20%,
yep.
They'll see sort of ghosts of antibodies. They've been averaged out. By measuring the density, they can actually sort of make a calculation as to how many are actually being found. So the next thing you would do is, if say you did that, you said, oh, it looks like the pentamers are a little bit weak, because maybe some of them are missing. Then you have to go backwards and say, okay, let's throw away the symmetry and try and do a reconstruction where we try and fish out that aspect.
Okay.
So you try and do your reconstruction in a way that gets all those pentamers aligned up with one another rather than smeared out 12 times. If you're lucky and it works, there's enough signal there to do that. Then you get a reconstruction which, you know, in the ideal case would show one completely empty.
Right.
If there was always one missing. And what you say, it sounds like maybe, let's say 50% of the time they were, 50%,
right.
You'd
right.
still then get one that was sort of weak.
So what about the other way? If, you know, you make these fusions, like Jack's doing on CPMP, and the fusion or attach a peptide or a protein. Maybe that's a better example. Take a capsid and attach a protein to it, but the protein is too big to sit at every equivalent site on a hexamer or a pentamer. Now you're gonna average it out, and you're gonna get a huge amount of sort of data that says this protein, this huge big protein, now is. How does that show up?
Yeah, again, you have some chance of being able to recognize it. So if it's too big, in fact, we actually published an example of this on cucumber mosaic virus.
Okay.
So the antibodies bind right around the fivefold axis, and you can't get more than two.
Right.
Okay, so we knew, for example, that there were. In the reconstruction of C5, they're weaker density. But because they're too big and there's not enough room, they also overlap. Where they overlap, the density goes up. So you can model it. You say, well, if I can model five antibodies and model each one at 1/5 or 2/5, whatever is the weight, then what are the overlap regions? What kind of density should you see there? And so you can look for that kind of consistency.
Okay.
Because they will overlap. And so that part will always have some density, so it'll show up.
And then you can ratio that overlap with the non-overlap.
So I mean, you can sort of play these games to try and interpret what you see. It does complicate things because the particle doesn't have a half-even symmetry.
Right. Right.
So it's not that easy. The other thing I think that's going to be kind of fun to do once we get to the point where we can actually do this reasonably routinely is to do tomography. So you just, it doesn't have to be high resolution. You just basically want to see, is there some population of my particles that has 30 antibodies as opposed to 60, and you can actually look at individual ones, lower resolution, but you'll see enough information that you'll see, oh yeah, this one's only got about half the number of sticks coming out of it than the other ones do. And then I think the next step would be, okay, if you actually prove to yourself that you do this populations, then the question is, with enough data, you should be able to go on a fishing expedition and say, find those that have that are most populated, get enough data, millions of particles, you say, well, just find me the best 5,000 out of that that have all the sites filled. And find those other five that are surrounded, the best 5,000 that are missing, and then make reconstructions of those separately. You have lots and lots of data.
And that, so doing that is going to get down to the sort of atomic level.
I think so. You have to basically find what can be averaged, as opposed to what is, by virtue of averaging, is actually smearing
it. And then, I mean, you could, in principle, then, if the smearing is due to small conformational changes, or you could, in principle, then separate
the seed. If you can produce classes, then you can produce
that's
several
exactly.
reconstructions.
Wow. That was great. Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
I have a question. Like, when you're saying like the picture or the data set is good or not, do you determine that the where the image is actually located in the symmetric unit, or do you kind of choose like some particles according to the location of their position in the symmetric unit?
Yeah, that's a good question. Generally speaking, we don't. We just basically say, does the particle image agree with the model? Like whatever criteria, and we don't care. We don't look and see. You know.
But you show like the example, they use only 9 images to generate like.
They would have. Yeah, you're right.
They would have to use.
They would have to make sure that those 9 were not just happened to be all along a threefold axis, just because for whatever reason those are better preserved in ice for some reason. Maybe they interact with the air water interface or something. You can imagine some physical reasons why that might be the case. But
I always think like those 9 images must have to be like distributed around the symmetric unit in order to get a
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I remember because I haven't looked at that paper in a while, but I think they actually have some data in there that shows that, you know, other questions you can ask: do they all come from the same micrograph? Maybe that one sample
That
one grid square just happened to be perfect. No, I think they come from different micrographs. Did they all come from the same region of? Or certain regions where they all
the ice is the same.
I think they were spread out. You know, so when they went from 130 to 44 to 9 or whatever, at each level, it was pretty much random picking. Didn't seem to be anything specific because they were looking for that. You know, like maybe it's just that particles are close to the carbon film are the best ones you should be picking out. You know, I don't think they got any specific. It's somewhat unfortunate because you might think, oh, great, if you can figure out what makes a particle good because of the way it's, because of its environment, then maybe we can make grids better or we can, you know, make the sample better. But it seems like it's a random thing.
But you can have, like, when you do the reconstruction in Fourier space, like you do the center section, do you have to use like a lot of like maybe if you have a lot of specimens or the images like in the same orientation or views, and do you have to use a weight for each image you want to combine the Fourier space?
We don't.
But what if you have a lot of images like with maybe the same orientation?
Yeah,
do you have to average first and convert to the Fourier space, or
you're not doing the averaging beforehand? We basically, when we do the reconstruction, each particle goes in by itself wherever it happens to be. So it's not, we don't do any kind of classification and say, oh, take all the particles that are this view, average them together, and then add that
into the
average transform in.
Okay.
So we don't do that. We basically let all the data go in as it is.
But what if, like, you have 2 images, like, with the same, maybe, orientation, and then they were add up, like, in the Fourier space?
Yeah, well, they should do that anyway, because if those 2 particles go in, and they have the same orientation, you'll create 2 data points that will get averaged during the reconstruction process itself.
But, I mean, they would add up, but if you have only 1 image for, say, if for this particular, like, view, you have like 10 images, but for the other view, you only have 1 image. So is that going to be affecting the final quality of the
We always normalize by the number of particles.
Oh, okay.
So we add up 10 points in the Fourier transform that come from 10 different images.
So you average
here, we divide by 10. So we take whatever amplitude we got, divide by 10. Over here, we only have 1 value, well, we have to take that 1 value. Of course, the signal to noise will be different in those 2 points. But we don't do anything about that at this point. We just say,
but that's essentially like kind of averaging in Fourier space. Like it's also averaging because you do the normalization.
It is averaging in Fourier space. Yes.
Oh, okay.
That's exactly what we do.
Yeah. So that means like you may have different like noise ratio.
Well, the thing is again, you know, in fact, actually, we do because each let's say those 10 all contribute to that same point in Fourier space. But let's say they came from 10 different micrographs at different defocus levels. So they will have associated with them, some of them may be near a node in the CTF, others may be near a peak, so we do weight according to that. So if that value comes from a value that's near a peak in the CTF, we say, well, we're confident about that. If it comes near a node, then we either toss it out or we really downweight it, significantly downweight it. So they are weighted in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as numbers, if you get 10 values over here, chances are you're going to get a better value for it than you do over here. We only have 1 value.
Yeah, that's true. Thanks.
Yep.